Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Defining Public Policy in a Free Society. Recorded in 2006, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, Tibor McCann, research fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor emeritus at Auburn University, professor of business ethics at Chapman University, and co-founder of Reason Magazine, and Tom G. Palmer, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, discuss public policy in a free society, examining both domestic and foreign policy issues. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Do you ever wonder just how our government decides on what policy issues to pursue, what positions to promote, and how to sell the ideas? More importantly, have you ever wondered how policy should be made in a free society? Well, joining me to discuss these issues are two gentlemen, one from one coast. This is Tibor McCann. He's a Hoover Institution Research Fellow, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Auburn, and Professor of Business Ethics at Chapman University, and a prolific writer from that point out, Tibor, and a co-founder of Reason Magazine. Welcome back to Dallas.
Thank you very much.
Glad you're here, and sitting next to you is the other coast, the East Coast, Tom Palmer. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, which is based in Washington, D.C. His primary areas of interest are political science and how societies move from less to more free. And Tom, I know you spent a lot of time in the former Soviet Union in the Middle East, which we'll talk about in a minute as well. But first of all, tell me and tell that viewer, what when we talk about public policy issues, what do we mean? What is domestic policy? How does it get defined? How does it get done? And what's wrong with it today?
Well, why don't we start with a little criticism of what I think is wrong with it, and that is too many people think the public policy is just getting enacted my preferences. For instance, I want something that you have. Well, that's public policy. I'm just going to have it taken from you. I'm going to get a subsidy that you, the taxpayer, or some other person has to pay for. It's not what the founders had in mind by public policy. By public, they meant something that affects all of us, and they contrasted it with the private interest. It might be in my private interest to confiscate your property, but it is definitely not in the public interest because it undermines the general institutions of rules and laws that make possible society in which the whole public benefits. So in the Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence, which animates the spirit of it, there's a sense that the public refers to those things that benefit all of us. And the foundation of that is a system of law and rights that allows us to live together peacefully, to engage in peaceful cooperation. The rule of law, that is the public good, is the maintenance of the rule of law. But too many people today think that the public good is me getting what I want, often at your expense. But if you're the one who suffers, I get the benefit. By definition, that's not a public good.
Okay. Tibor, the morality of it in terms of the public versus the private interest is sort of what gets your attention.
Yes. One of the problems that we find is that there's this temptation to have a one-size-fits-all society. And it is indeed one of the revolutionary contributions of the American founders to have made us aware of individualism, that we are really different. We have certain things in common. Those are our basic rights, unalienable rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and a few other things. But that's all that we really share. The rest of it is highly individuated. And so when people talk about the public, that means those things we have in common, a very few things. The rest of society, private life, religious life, academic, all of those things have to be adjusted to the fact that we're individuals. We are very different. Some of us have some things in common. Others have some things in common. But what is right and good will depend on who you are, not just on some one-size-fits-all model that has been thought up by some philosopher many years ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tom, when you talk about these public policy issues, most of which are private these days, we're going to come back to those, but what if we were living in a almost perfect society, what would public policy issues be, at least on the domestic front?
Well, primarily the maintenance of a system of the rule of law. It's the responsibility of government to maintain a system of courts to adjudicate disputes among citizens in a fair and honest and objective manner. And also it's a responsibility to protect our rights, maintenance of the police power and of national defense, an actual national defense as opposed to adventurism around the globe. So that the public policy questions there are, how many judges do we want to have? How many police? And then on the border area, how are we going to enforce certain laws and rights? For instance, there are important issues about water rights that need to be adjudicated throughout the American West. You can't figure it out just by reading a book. These are difficult issues, and we need a system of law to make sure that property rights and water are respected, and therefore the water will be efficiently used and everyone will be happy with it. Those are public policy issues. But subsidizing my taste in art, this comes at the expense of people who don't share my taste in art. It's not public policy as such. It's not really benefiting the public. It's just subsidizing my interest. Where I live in Washington, D.C., all the taxpayers in the rest of the country get to pay for people who live in Washington to enjoy the Kennedy Center. It's called the public good, but believe me, it's to the benefit of a small class of people who get subsidized opera tickets. That's not part of a free society to force people in Nebraska to pay for opera in Washington.
Well, how do we get to this? How do we get so far off track? Or were we off track in the beginning? Or has this just been something that's gradually happened in the time that our country's been in existence?
Well, there's a natural human desire to want to steal what other people have. This is something that you notice among children. The concept of mine and thine, as the founder said, what's your stuff and what's my stuff, has to be learned. And children, about the age of 4 or 5, begin to get that idea very well. First, they understand mine. Everyone gets that. Thine, oh, that's a harder concept. What is not mine but belongs to you. But we teach it to our children. We expect them to grow up with those values. Unfortunately, when they get elected to Congress, they forget their upbringing. And then everything is mine. Everything is there for me to redistribute to other people. I think that's one of the real problems, is this desire to take other people's property, to force other people to subsidize my life. And the state is a very convenient mechanism to do it. So it converts the pursuit of the public good into a gang war, if you will, a fight over resources. That's certainly not what the founders had in mind, this mass search for subsidies, all the lobbyists crawling over Washington, D.C. Everyone is there for a purpose. They want to get a piece of the public's money. That is not pursuing the public good by any means. The public good requires, in my opinion, and in the opinion of the founders, a limited government, a strictly limited government, limited to those things that really affect the public, like national defense, maintenance of the rule of law, and possibly a few other limited categories of public goods.
Okay, now, Tibor, I'm going to take his example that he threw out there of art in Washington, D.C., whether it's art in Dallas or art in California, whatever. I mean, the argument that people would make is that you can't have a civilized society, Tibor, without having art, and not everybody can afford good art, so consequently, there should be taxpayer-supported art of all kinds, and so that becomes a public policy issue because art's good for everybody.
Well, you know what a non sequitur is when something doesn't follow. Now, it's quite true that you cannot have a civilization without art, without culture, with a whole bunch of goodies, important things. It doesn't follow, however, that this is a government job. This is a job for various parts of society. Family, church, clubs, institutions of all kinds that we haven't even thought of would make these things available in a free society. For those who are too poor, there's always charitable, generous service institutions that provide them. There are very few people who would not get some of these goodies from a truly free society, which would keep government to its proper business. The moment the government gets into these things, and there's always some appeal, oh, just in this case, well, just in the case of science, or just in the case of the arts, or just in the case of education, immediately opens the floodgates, and everybody then starts running to the government and say, well, how about my special interest? That's an important thing, too. So you have to have discipline in this case. Sometimes the discipline is a little bit harsh, but then so is quitting smoking. That's a discipline. You have to restrain yourself. Now, there's another thing, though. In most of our higher education discussions of public affairs, of politics, these kinds of things, remember those higher educational institutions are mostly public institutions, a few prominent private ones, but a great many state universities, state colleges, junior colleges, almost all of those are state. So there's very little discussion of this issue because they don't like to bite the hands that feeds them. So there is very little discussion of individualism properly understood in these contexts. Most of the thinkers who speak out, who get a good deal of airtime and well published, are people who believe that we are not individuals actually, that we are cells of a larger body, the community,
the society.
The society. Mm-hmm. So this is the underlying philosophical rationalization for getting you suckered into doing everything and everything being a part of the public. Because they don't recognize that you have a personal, private realm, a sovereign realm that is you, and that needs to be consulted if you're to be recruited for it rather than conscripted for it.
Okay, but that's a great libertarian position, but Tom, I may be wrong about this, but I think Tibor actually alluded to the fact that education itself is not a, quote, public good. Now, we've just spent years here in Texas trying to revamp the school finance system. That has happened in state after state around the country, trying to figure out ways to either redistribute how the taxes are done, or in most cases raise them and change them and redistribute them so nobody knows exactly which pod the pea is under, so to speak. What about education? I mean, education is a huge public policy issue.
Oh, it's a very big public policy issue. Let's look at it from the perspective of whether it's a public good. The economists define a public good as having two characteristics. The first is it's what's called non-rivalrous in consumption. What that means is that if you consume it, there's no less for me. Right? Unlike an apple has rivalrous consumption. If you eat a bite of the apple, there's one less bite available for me. But a public good is one such that if we're listening to the same music, it doesn't get dimmer if you're listening as well. Mm-hmm. All right? So there are a lot of goods like that that have a public characteristic. The other is that they're costly to exclude. It's difficult to exclude people from enjoying it, and therefore difficult to get them to pay for it. So those are the two characteristics of an economically defined public good. Is education a public good? Well, the argument is, well, it creates the foundation for a free society, to have an educated workforce.
Yeah, even Jefferson said many years ago that you have to have this educated populace to have some sort of republic.
And I generally concur with that. The problem with the argument is it assumes that the overwhelming majority of the benefit of education goes to someone other than the person being educated. That's manifestly false. Take the example of higher education. People who go to college and get out with a college degree on average earn substantially more than people who don't have a college degree. Well, why shouldn't they pay for that extra income that they're going to earn over the course of their lives?
Or their parents.
Or their parents. But they are internalizing the benefit in the form of a higher income. It seems to me they ought to pay. But under the current system, what we do is we require people who are not going to college to pay the tuition bills of people who are going to college, who will, as a consequence, earn a higher income. That doesn't seem just to me.
Well, maybe not, but Tibor, look, I mean, I can say that because my neighbor is college educated, that I, as a member of society, benefit because more and more people are educated. They make more money, pay more taxes, so consequently, I am on net better off because of that, and I ought to be subsidizing higher education for that reason.
See, it may indeed be the case that it would be a good thing for you to do so, to subsidize this, but it's very different from saying that you may be coerced to do so. There are a lot of nice things that people ought to do in life. There are a lot of things that they may even be obligated to do, morally obligated, but it doesn't follow one whit that the gun must be put to their head and they must be made to do it. In a civilized society, a truly civilized society, human beings interact by way of reasoning, by persuading one another that something is good, and then bringing those people on board if they choose to be. If they don't choose to be, they may be wrong, but we don't put a gun to their head, not unless they violate someone's rights. And you do not have a right to be educated by other people. You don't have a right to get your health taken care of by other people, because that would enslave them. That would put them into a form of involuntary servitude. They would become your little servants, your serfs. That is the era that the founders rejected, when the kings basically treated everybody as a serf. We are independent human beings, sovereign individuals. And even when something is the right thing to do, we must do it because we choose to do it. That's what a free society means. And these people who keep stressing the fact that, yes, you would benefit from your neighbor's education, forget about this. They refuse to address the fundamental issue that when human beings benefit from one another's contribution, they must do so by choice, voluntarily, not at the point of a gun.
Okay, now I'm going to shift to foreign policy, because I think both of you would agree that, in spite of the fact that you all believe in a limited government, that foreign policy is basically at least a government function generally. Would that be fair to say? Other than, you know, people trading, obviously, which are private things. But in terms of the country's foreign policy, what would foreign policy look like in a free society versus what you see it might look like today, Tom?
Well, let's just go to the Constitution, the document that gives legitimacy to the acts of the federal government, at least. It says to provide for the common defense. It does not say in order to liberate other people around the world, although that might be a nice thing to do. It is not a constitutionally authorized function of our government. It does not say to spread democracy around the world. I'm really happy when other countries become democratic, and I personally dedicate my life and my time to doing that. But it doesn't follow that I have to conscript you into my projects. If I go someplace that's a little scary and dangerous, I do that at my own risk. If the U.S. government sends someone there, they do it at the risk of all of us. So I think that a foreign policy should be focused primarily on the defense of the United States. But that means the United States. It doesn't even mean every American. If you go on your own and you want to travel to North Korea, one of the scariest places on the planet, you get caught because you're smuggling in Bibles or doing something else like that. Very courageous people do these things. You do so at your own risk. You don't have the right to then force other Americans to subsidize your security, for example. So I think that a foreign policy should be rational. It should be focused on what is actually defense. And if it's not defense of the United States, it shouldn't be part of our foreign policy.
Okay, let's just take Iraq as an example. So in 2003, this administration ended up taking us to war in Iraq. I can make the case, as they tried to make, that doing a preemptive strike, effectively, was an appropriate form of defense, because even though Saddam may or may not have been a threat at that time or in the near term, that ultimately, because of the, let's say, the discord that he and other people like him sowed throughout the Middle East, that was a threat to U.S. and U.S. interest. How would you respond?
Several things. Number one, I'm very happy that he's in prison, a really vicious psychopath. So it's not a question of defending that regime. But we were misled. It turns out that they didn't have these weapons of mass destruction. I think actually the president and others believe they did. I don't think they lied to us about that. They did mislead us about connections between Saddam and 9/11. There were no connections, but they always said Saddam, 9/11, Saddam, 9/11. That was deeply misleading. I supported the war against the Taliban as an act of self-defense by the United States. I think that was appropriate. The war with Iraq, in my mind, was very, very different. It was about pursuing a different agenda. The strongest case that they made was the potential that Saddam would have weapons of mass destruction and would deliver them to Osama, which is a non-deterrable delivery mechanism with no return address. That was the strongest case. I was willing to be convinced. I listened. They did not convince me. They did not present the evidence. Frankly, the final poke in the eye was when they gave George Tenet the Medal of Freedom. The person responsible for the bad intelligence, maybe in a sense it wasn't his fault, but you don't give him a medal for producing bad intelligence on the basis of which we have committed ourselves many thousands of lives and trillions of dollars that we are pouring over there. But there's another issue. Having made this disastrous decision, what do we do now? And that's the point at which grown-ups have to say, what now? It is not obvious to me, but I do think the United States should make it clear we are going to be withdrawing our troops there. They are going to have to deal with their own security. Not tomorrow, not next week, not a pell-mell rush to the exits, but there has to be some process of disengagement because it is not part of our national defense. If anything, I think that the war with Iraq made us less secure rather than more. In other words, the opposite of the purpose.
All right. Now, Tibor, from your standpoint, we try to, or you try to at least, get these foreign policy issues, domestic policy issues, in some sort of framework of what is not only right for the United States as a free society to do, but also is on a moral level that means that we're doing the right thing morally. So feed me some of that.
Just because it is true that other countries also ought to be free, that they ought to have a constitution that respects individual rights and so on, it doesn't follow that our country is obligated to go out and set everything right. Imagine if you have a bodyguard who's been hired to protect you from attackers. Now, there can be many things wrong in your neighborhood, but your bodyguard was hired by you. He or she owes you the duty of defending you, not to run off and do some other people's business, even if those are good things to do. They have to find volunteers. They have to find people who are willing to do that, not at the expense of those who've already hired. We hired our government to defend us. I have what I call a defensivist approach to foreign policy. When it comes to our rights, our government owes us the defense. When it comes to other people's rights, our government owes us a good example. Diplomacy, a good example. Look what happens when the United States starts becoming aggressive in its defense of liberty. It becomes an oxymoron. It becomes self-contradictory. The U.S. loses the moral high ground. A lot of countries around the world can then point to the U.S. saying, you're no better than we are. You know, you're running roughshod of your citizens for a cause you believe in. The U.S. ought to just stick to the policy of defending its citizens' rights. Now, there are gray areas. It's not always absolutely clear what is a clear and present danger, what is a probable cause. There you actually have to be on the ground and know the case. But it's not good enough, for example, for President Bush or Vice President Cheney or anybody else to have believed. Those beliefs have to be well-grounded. If you believe that your wife is cheating on you, but you're totally paranoid and there is no evidence for it, your punishing her for it is not justified. Your beliefs ought to be straightened out. And what the problem is that here the beliefs were ill-founded and they were almost like a kind of wishful thinking more than well-grounded on military intelligence.
Now there's, if I could add another point there, that both parties are guilty of having different kinds of, I think, absurd foreign policies. Under the Democrats, they wanted to intervene any place they thought there was not a U.S. interest, which is sort of a novel and interesting approach. The Republicans say, if we have an interest there, we shouldn't intervene. The Democrats said, no, we should only intervene where we don't have an interest. So they bring up cases like Sudan, the Darfur tragedy and monstrosity that's happening there, and Yugoslavia. But I remember Madeleine Albright saying something that was so shocking to me. She said to Colin Powell when he was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, what's the point of having this big army if we never use it? What a mentality to think that you should go use it because you have it. The point of having a well-trained military is not to have to use it because it deters people from attacking you. Her view was, what a cool thing to have. Look at what we can do in the world. Not thinking about the dangers to which this exposed us and the fact that she's committing resources that are not just hers to commit. They're there for a purpose.
There's another dimension that I want to cover briefly. One of the difficulties that someone like I has with the current debates in Washington is that here are the Democrats complaining about preemptive actions on the part of George W. Bush, whereas in almost all other areas like environment or government regulation of business, they are advocating preemptive action all the time. They're not waiting until some person in the business world actually commits a crime. No, they're building a huge government regulatory agency and manipulating these people's behavior. But suddenly, when it comes to foreign affairs, they become purist about, well, you can only do it. This is such hypocrisy that it's very difficult to live with.
Well, let me, in just a couple of minutes that we have left, Tom, let me start with you here. But you've spent a lot of time in the Middle East, publishing books over there, dealing with people, et cetera. One of the issues that people have with our policy is that, at least the perception from this side of the ocean, that we may have squandered the goodwill that we had after 9/11 by the actions that we've taken. Give us your feeling about what you see on the street in the Middle East.
I think that's substantially the case. It was very costly to the United States to pursue this heavy-handed interventionist policy. It's also the case, though, that even when we see, let's take the case of American soldiers charged with crimes, people do also see them being prosecuted. This is, in a sense, the silver lining. It's a very dark cloud, but there is some silver lining. Most places in the world, these things happen every day and no one is prosecuted. We still have some connection to the rule of law in the United States, and our military has a commitment to the maintenance of military law. It was, after all, Navy investigators who brought up this Haditha case. It wasn't some foreigners who brought this up. And there's a certain sense in which I do take some pride in that. And many people do recognize it. They say, those Americans, they did some bad things, but what a surprise, it looks like they're going to be prosecuted from within their own system. That is
so there is some recognition that that happens, in your opinion.
Some recognition is the key word, some. A lot of work has to be done to undo what I think has been a generally bad reputation from the U.S. But here's one thing that's quite remarkable. You can sometimes meet with people, Arabs and others, who they're very angry with the United States. Then you say, well, where do you want to live? Oh, America. America. I want to come to America.
I got that. Well, I appreciate both of you on this policy issue, and I appreciate your joining us, because one thing that surely must be true is that an informed citizenry is necessary if we are to remain a free society, regardless of who is making the policy. Our job on this program is to make sure that you are part of the informed, because as always, we've been talking about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.